I've got Gareth Smith here from Byron Bay. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning, Adrienne. Good to be with you.
Just check I can hear you properly. Okay. Thanks for ringing in this morning, Gareth.
Oh, that's a pleasure.
Now, would you like to tell the listeners what you thought of the Peace Convergence?
Yes, I was extremely impressed with the way in which the folks up there at Yeppoon and Rockhampton had got everything together in preparation for us. They'd done a tremendous amount of work. And Peace Convergence itself, based in Brisbane, had correlated all the different requests for camping accommodation, for all the information sets that we needed to be appraised of. All of that information was, you know, dealt with by them in a very efficient way. It was a really big operation, and I must say that the military could probably learn quite a bit from the logistics that Peace Convergence and the folks up at Yeppoon had employed.
And, of course, on a shoestring budget compared to the $22 billion a year the Australian Defence Force spend.
Oh, absolutely. And it never ceases to shock me to find the kinds of comments that we were exposed to 25, 30 years ago still there, floating around as usual. One of the journalists on the Bulletin newspaper based in Rockhampton, into whose offices Mark Gwyneth and myself, Mark from Canberra, and myself dressed as a town crier with a large brass bell, we went into their offices and rang the bell very loudly and shouting, oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. And I think the employees of the newspaper thought there was a fire alarm because they came pouring out of their offices.
Yeah, that was great, your street theatre.
But then the journalist, Jenny Lightfoot, one of the first questions was, oh, I've been watching a documentary about the blockading of the river in Tasmania. And she said, and of course it was Rent-A-Crowd, and you're basically Rent-A-Crowd, aren't you? And I said, well, that's a great idea, Jenny. Just point out who the renter might be. Because all of us are doing this hard. We're paying our own way. And in my case, I'm losing a day's pay for every day I'm up here.
And that's a very important point, because there was the odd Rockhampton or Yeppoon hoon, that's the only way I can describe it, because they're roaring past very fast in big cars that would yell out, get a job and go back to the dole queue. And there was a lot of people there that had taken time off work and parenting and other things to be there. A lot of people actually mentioned that. So that old stereotype of the dole bludging hippie protester is blown out of the water as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's just, but to find people who really ought to know better than to trot out that old hoary nonsense.
I know.
You know, a journalist with a regional newspaper coming out with that crap.
Yes, it's interesting that the ABC in Rockhampton said that they weren't interested in reporting unless there was a large number of arrests. That was what they said to one woman that went in and spoke to them. Luckily, our regional ABC has been given good coverage to this, and also all our local radio stations to let people know what was going on. And would you like to tell the listeners anything you're working on at the moment that is to do with this issue of the Australian bases and the Australian Defence Force involvement in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yes, Adrian. It's interesting that it's possible that our own local population is better informed, thanks to our independent media and our regional ABC, better informed about Talisman Sabre than the folks up in the area where it's taking place.
Yeah.
Because we met locals, including university students doing environmental science, who had never heard of Talisman Sabre.
I know. It's quite amazing, isn't it?
It is. It is incredible. Anyway, what's happening, I think it should be important to point out that we're not against adequate training for our defence force.
That's right.
Because they have been involved in peacekeeping operations around the world as part of the United Nations. That seems to be a very justifiable use for the defence force. And closer to home, our own region is quite unstable. We've had lots of bloodshed in East Timor. And there's problems up in Papua New Guinea, particularly from West Papua, where the Indonesian military are behaving barbarously, as usual. There are lots of things that could occupy our military right here where we live, and certainly in terms of disaster relief, down in Victoria, for example, at the central coast. So, yes, by all means, let's our ADF be trained properly, but what's happening with Talisman Sabre and the Defense Department are quite blasé about this. They say, yes, you know, we want our troops to work seamlessly with their American counterparts. A hand-in-glove arrangement. So then that raises the question, well, what exactly are our troops being trained for? And then the next question is, why is it that they've built a mock town that is very obviously a Middle Eastern mock-up, with Arabic music being played, containing three mosques? We've talked to a builder who worked on them, with street furniture, that's the term that the Defense Department in Canberra uses, which comprises street stalls, with people dressed in Arabic garb, with wrecked cars strewn everywhere around the streets. So in effect, it's a little Baghdad right here in close to Rockhampton.
And this is what they call urban warfare training, I believe.
That's it, urban warfare training. So that's one clue about what our troops are being trained for. It's got nothing to do with our immediate region, but very much to do with the Middle East. And so that raises the issue, where next? Is Iran the next target of opportunity for the United States military? And, as in the case of the illegal invasion of Iraq, when our own SAS troops were inserted into Iraq before the actual invasion took place, they were some of the first people on the ground doing sabotage, doing reconnaissance and stuff like that. Are SAS troops already in Iran? Are they there at this moment? We don't know. We'll only find out perhaps 30 years down the track when FOI releases those documents. But the other question that comes up here is, if our troops are working seamlessly with the Americans, and the Americans have changed their military doctrine, but now they have a doctrine based on the use of miniature nuclear weapons.
That's right.
And nothing is clearer than the Australian of Tuesday, June the 19th. Because what we find there is a report which ought to have been headlines in the media all around this country, but in fact it's placed on the middle pages of the Australian, and it features an interview, or a report rather, of an interview in Britain with a former British ambassador to Washington, a chap called Christopher Mayer, and this is what he told the British newspaper The Mirror. He said, Tony Blair's real concern was that there would be a knee-jerk reaction by the Americans. They would go thundering off and nuke the shit out of the place without thinking straight. Now, what he's talking about is Afghanistan, and he's talking there about Tony Blair's real fear that the Americans would nuke Afghanistan. Now, why is this not news across Australia? Why aren't our headlines screaming with this information? And he said that that's the reason that Blair allowed British troops to join the Americans in Afghanistan, so they could operate some kind of restraint on the Americans. So this is a kind of a break that they wanted to apply to Bush. Well, now, of course, Blair is no longer in office. One wonders whether Mr. Brown, his replacement, will be able to exercise this breaking effect on the Bush administration. Now, the only way that Bush could use nuclear weapons in Afghanistan is because those nuclear weapons are no longer the blockbusters that they were going to use against the Soviet Union, but these are miniature nuclear weapons which are indistinguishable from weapons packed with TNT or Semtex. Right. And that means that the Americans have changed their doctrine to be able to use nuclear weapons in the battlefield. So how does that then apply to our Australian troops, who are working seamlessly, hand in glove, with them? it implies very strongly that our troops are being trained in nuclear use tactics, and Mr. Howard should address that question.
And it is recorded in the Hansard report that we have depleted uranium weapons, the Australian Defence Force, and have made a decision a few weeks back to purchase cluster bombs. Which
yes, I mean, that in the face of almost universal opposition to cluster bombs, Australia's Senate votes for them. I mean, that is just an act of absolute bastardry.
It is, and like with so what strategies have you actually got in place that you would like to use or could you recommend to people to show opposition to these sort of decisions that are, and the future mapped out according to the Australian Defence Forces that we will be in the Middle East, our forces, for a couple of decades?
Oh, that's right. They're talking about a virtually endless engagement in the Middle East. And it's particularly frightening to think that when a rat is cornered, it can behave with incredible savagery. And I think, if you remember, Margaret Thatcher's political fortunes were definitely in the decline. And up popped the opportunity of invading the Falklands. And so the Falklands War was born. And as a consequence of British victory in the Falklands, at a tremendous human cost, of course, Margaret Thatcher rode high once again and survived a poll defeat. Now, if you think of Bush, who's hanging on by his fingernails in the US with a very strident call now to get him impeached, it's tempting to think that perhaps Bush might emulate Thatcher and has already said that all cards are on the table as far as Iran is concerned. There's already an aircraft carrier battle fleet in the Straits of Hormuz, in the Persian Gulf. They're right there, on target, and they've already had aggressive war games to, instill terror into the Iranian regime and get them to come to the negotiating table on American terms. So it's very tempting to think that that Bush might initiate an irrational attack on Iran, just as irrational as a nuclear attack on Afghanistan. That might well be the next scenario that we have to cope with. And in addition to that, I'm glad to say that Americans traversing the north of Africa, going to Morocco and Algeria and other places, trying to find host countries willing to have a permanent American base there so that the Americans can set up what they call AFRICOM, Africa Command. They've been turned down by those two countries. Why are the Americans trying to set up permanent bases in Africa? Well, it's because African countries like Mali and Chad have got strategic minerals like cobalt, and they've got uranium, and the Americans want these things. They've also got oil, as in the case of Nigeria. So where there are things America wants, that's where America is going to insert its military might. And Australia, if it's going to be working alongside them so closely in the Howard administration's view of the world, we can expect to see Aussie troops being deployed perhaps in some African country. And I don't hold out much hope that a Rudd-led government is going to behave very differently in regard to the US.
We were informed by Hannah Middleton and also Dr. Helen Caldicott that there's 36 US facilities in Australia at the moment, which could be called bases.
Sure, and more of them are being planned. Delamere in the Northern Territory, for example, according to Matthew Peacock of the 730 report, that 750 US Marines in an expeditionary force will be permanently based at Delamere in the Northern Territory. And there are similar claims being made for Shoalwater Bay, of course. And it's not surprising when you get up to one of the gates into that military training area, a huge sign which says, "Welcome to the world's best military training area." And it's not just America that's using those facilities, that beautiful, pristine ecology. It's also the Singaporean Armed Forces who are allowed to use that for their military training for 45 days a year between July and December every year.
That's right. And also, I believe the Japanese Defence Force was here invited as an observer for Talisman Sabre, because of course a lot of Japanese troops are going to be based in Guam in the future.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up, Adrian, because as you, as listeners probably are aware, Japan has got its self-defense constitution. Article 9 of the Japanese constitution forbids the Japanese military to be deployed outside of Japan. But of course that doesn't suit American strategic objectives. They want to see Japan, which, although it's limited to spending 1% of its gross national product on the military, for a rich country like Japan, that 1% represents a hell of a lot of military hardware. What a pity to just see it tied up around Japan itself. How much better it would be to free the Japanese from that constraint and let them act as an American surrogate in the Northern Pacific region, as a counterweight to North Korea, perhaps, and also as a potential counterweight against China. So we're seeing Japan now deploying troops to Afghanistan as part of the Coalition of the Willing, and they've also engaged in peacekeeping efforts with the United Nations, and that's just the thin edge of the wedge to get the Japanese population attuned, and perhaps the Asia-Pacific region attuned to the idea of a more expeditionary Japanese military. And then the next thing to think about is an amazing amount of plutonium that the Japanese have accumulated. Far, far in excess of any rational nuclear power generation needs. Why has Japan got this massive plutonium stockpile? Is it possible? And I've got friends in Japan who tell me yes. They're in the Japanese Conservative Party. They are thinking and talking about Japan becoming a nuclear-armed nation to protect them against North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Again, that would certainly comply with America's strategic objectives to have a nuclear-armed Japan. Then it raises the issue about Australia itself. John Howard's push, his irrational enthusiasm for numerous nuclear power plants along the east coast of Australia, defying the limitations of drought conditions, ignoring the fact that these stations are incredibly thirsty beasts, and then talking about the need for an enrichment industry in Australia, then makes you wonder that in the 1950s, the Menzies government were desperate for Australia to get atomic bombs, so much so that they allowed the British to detonate the equivalent of 23 Hiroshima-sized bombs in Australia at Maralinga and Montebello. Leonard Bickel's great book describes the actual explosive force of those explosions, so it's quite easy to calculate how many Hiroshima bombs that's the equivalent of. So they did that. They allowed the centre of Australia, and not just the centre, but South Australia, Queensland, were also irradiated with that atomic dust. And then they bought V-bombers from Britain, the Valiant and the Vulcan, and they were atomic bomb-capable bombers. That was another sop to the British. And at the end of it all, the British refused to share their atomic secrets with Australia, so we didn't get the bomb. And I think it's possible that John Howard is entertaining notions of Australia becoming a nuclear-armed power.
Well, it appears that way, doesn't it? With everything that's been happening, it's a great concern to a lot of people. And we're going to have to wind up soon, actually, because Gail is actually here, and she's starting a program shortly after me.
All right.
Thank you so much for ringing in with all this information. And just want to leave you with one question. Is there anything that you would recommend? People are saying, what can we do?
Yeah,
a lot of
definitely.
People really don't know how to approach this issue.
Well,
if you've got any suggestions?
Yes, a quick answer to that is, let's use freedom of information legislation. Let's pepper the Defense Department in Canberra with FOI requests about the results of environmental testing up at Shoalwater Bay, because they've not been released. And all you have to do, listeners, all you have to do is say, I am applying under Freedom of Information Legislation, brackets 1982.
Okay.
1982.
So they contact Brendan Nelson, or
whoever you like.
Because we
any Commonwealth department, any state government department, they're all subjected to that legislation. And you can address the inquiry to the Freedom of Information Officer.
Okay.
And then you just say, my request is in the public interest, and I request all charges to be waived, to be cancelled.
Okay, because otherwise you get hit with a charge, do you?
You get hit with a charge otherwise.
Okay.
And I would also encourage people to contact their local Member of Parliament to ask them pertinent questions about where Australia's foreign policy is going and what's happened with our military in concert with the Americans, and get them to answer the question. I mean, Justine Elliott has sent us a broadsheet telling us, you know, how, what's this and what's that, but there's no contact details on that broadsheet, no telephone number, no email address. So, you know, here I am, but you're not encouraged to contact me.
Yeah. So that's a good way, because a lot of people have been saying, well, what can we do? So that's one really good strategy.
And talk back radio and write letters to the editors of local newspapers and national papers. It's a bit of a drag, I know, but and they'll probably not print what you write anyway, but do it.
Yeah.
Please do it.
Yeah, because this is the time is now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it is an election year, so it's more likely that people will have an impact in an election year.
Yes.
So it's an opportunity.
And every written letter they get in Parliament House, they've got a formula which signals this. There are at least 60 or 80 people in the community who think like this letter writer.
That's
so
right.
You can have an effect much greater than just yourself.
That's right.
Yeah. Well,
thank you so much for ringing in today, Gareth, and thanks for all that amazing information.
Thank you.
And we'll speak to you again in the future.
Okay.
Bye-bye.